I was thinking about our most recent election cycle, and I had problems assigning an adjective that accurately captured my feelings about it. I thought, well, it was interesting. I said, no, that's not it. It was outrageous. Yeah, it was outrageous, but that's not it either. And I settled on extraordinary. You know, it was outside the norm. This was an extraordinary election cycle. Certainly the most extraordinary election cycle of my lifetime, perhaps of your lifetime as well. I mean, from the selection of two extraordinary candidates to the extraordinary things that these candidates said and did. But I think the most extraordinary admission that came out didn't actually come from either of the candidates. I think that it came from the director of the FBI, James Comey. And of course, I'm thinking about when there was just 10 days, as you know, before we were going to have our election, and this director comes out and says, hey, well, one of these candidates, by the way, is under investigation currently, federally. He says, well, that's surprising. That's certainly shocking, not because the candidate in question was, you know, the possibility of corruption with that candidate isn't what shocked us. You know, whether or not that candidate is corrupt or just morally questionable, we were more shocked that that candidate might actually get caught for doing something than the implication that there was something wrong with them. And of course, suddenly, Comey is the one who's under investigation. You know, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Is he some paragon of moral virtue, or is he a corrupt government official trying to sway the election? I'm not an expert on the man. You know, he appeared to me to be a fellow trying to live by his moral compass, trying to live with integrity. But what I see when I look at how he was treated, not just prior to the election, but post the election, is that we are not a people who want integrity. We want loyalty. We don't want someone who is standing for their idea of what is right and good and true. We want someone who will partner with us in our ideas of what's right in our eyes, what's good. And if that means I'm taking a little on the side, well, I want you to do it as well. Don't rock the boat. Sit down. It reminds me of the character that we look at in our text today. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 5 if you want to meet me there. We're going to start at the very end of chapter 5, verse 31. The majority of our text is in chapter 6. And we're going to cover the last of the major narratives in the book of Daniel. Now, chapter 7 and onward are mainly going to be dealing with visions and prophecies which Daniel received throughout his lifetime. And our text today is, of course, going to be one of the most well-known passages of Scripture. I think of David and... Think of Jonah and of course now we have Daniel and, got it, that's right. You know, we had just recently, I don't know if it was this past vacation Bible school or the one before it, that we had Daniel in the lion's den was one of the things covered, and we had this song that was attached to it. I'm not going to tell you, it is a weapon of mass distraction. You will never forget it. Those of you who are here probably are going to have it in your head for the rest of the service. My daughter would sing it on the way home after vacation Bible school, and she would get everything right until the very last word. You know, it wasn't Daniel in the lion's den. She was Daniel in the lion's cup. I don't know where she was getting that from. I was trying to tell her. I said, Piper, it's not cup, it's den. And she said, no, it's cup. Okay, I guess you know better than I do. We're dealing with Daniel and the lion's den. So if you'll pick it up with me today, chapter 5, verse 31 is where we're going to start. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And it seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Now, the curtain has just come down on the Babylonian Empire in our story. And the kingdom has been transferred to the Medo-Persians, okay? Babylon is now under the rule of a man known as Darius. So if I'm thinking of this period in time, the book of Daniel, and our Lord is going to refer to it as this time of the Gentiles. I think of that statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. It's gold head, silver chest and arms, bronze abs, iron legs, iron and clay feet. So we're looking at how these kingdoms are going to change hands. And as we've walked through Daniel, we've talked about how it's going to be first Babylon, this head of gold. Last week we watched the transfer from the head of gold from Babylon to the next world empire. This is Medo-Persia. Darius the Mede is a ruler of Medo-Persia. Really, he's a general. When we're thinking of Medo-Persia, I'm thinking of Cyrus the Great. And Darius is probably the general who conquered Babylon for Cyrus the Great. Okay, he's given this kingdom in a foreign land, but as a military man, the only foreign policy he knows is scorched earth. So what he's going to do is he's going to assign some politicians to help him rule this kingdom. He's got 120 of them. Okay, satraps, we can think of them as like governors. Now, he also has governors there, but they're essentially ruling over provinces. And then above them, he has three individuals. They're kind of like the FBI. They're kind of like the internal affairs. They're going to make sure that these 120 guys aren't taking advantage of Darius. Okay, because he's not really privy to the ins and outs. He wants them to handle business for them. And as we'll find out, they're going to take advantage of him. But nonetheless, they're the stopgap. They're going to make sure the king does not suffer loss. Now, in the progression of our story, in God's narrative, we've been watching the individual rule. God gave his rule to a man named Adam. At the beginning, we saw that rule was usurped in Genesis 3, and God gave his philosophy how he was going to fix that problem, how he was going to restore creation to his original desire and have a man ruling over creation. It was the promise of this seed of a woman in Genesis 3:15. When we got to Genesis 12, God instituted another program, another structure and economy of how God is going to run this world. Okay, he instituted a governing system. In Genesis 9, we have human government come on the scene. In Genesis 12, God says, I'm going to make a nation out of this man, Abraham. It's through him that all the families of the earth will be blessed. Okay, the seed of the woman is coming through this nation. And when we're thinking of like a story, any story, you know, you watch a movie, the setting in a story is going to be everything up until the conflict. So for this individual rule, this man, Adam, the setting we saw, God pops up, he's the hero, he makes a garden. The setting is everything up until this antagonist comes up on the scene and Adam rebels against the Lord. Okay, what about for the nation? Well, the setting is going to be everything before the conflict. And we're going to find that national conflict popped up in 1 Kings 11. Okay, God gave the people a nation, right? He turned Abraham into a nation. He gave them a land from which to rule. He gave them a law so they can know how to represent him and his desires. He gave them his special dwelling among them so they can say, hey, the true creator God, he is the one who is leading us. He even gave them his king, his representative, through whom his desire, his wills will be represented over the other nations. But in 1 Kings 11, we saw Solomon rebelled against the Lord. He started going after other gods. That's the conflict. Okay? And what happens after that, just like we think of Genesis 3, okay, Adam was kicked out of the garden. He's not running things anymore. We're looking for a new Adam, the last Adam that's going to do it. In the same way, Israel's been kicked out of the land. Okay? They don't got a king. They don't got a land. They can't follow the law. God's special dwelling is not with them anymore. He's left the temple, they're out in exile. Okay? And we're waiting for this. How is this going to be resolved? God, what are you going to do about it? Is it over for us? Have you changed your mind or you're not going to make good on your promises? And that's where the book of Daniel is fitting in. God's going to give his philosophy through this book of Daniel and tell us, this is how we're solving the problem. Okay? So part of that is coming with this transfer here, this time of the Gentiles. Okay, so now we have Darius, the second Gentile king in a four Gentile kingdom setup that God is going to accomplish His purposes at the end of which. Okay, so here we are. Look at verse 3. Daniel's one of these three governors working for Darius, internal affairs department. And this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. And then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was found in him. And then these men said, "We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." So Daniel is standing out, not because, you know, he's wrecking the place, not because he's protesting, not because he's trying to get them to change their system or some way adopt Israel's idea of the law, Israel, what Israel followed in order to represent God. No, he stands out because he possesses an extraordinary spirit. And what I find extraordinary in this passage is not that Daniel would be found, you know, wiser or more capable than everybody around him. I mean, after all, in chapter 1, you know, the Lord gave Daniel knowledge and intelligence so that he was found 10 times sharper than any of the other attacks that were in Babylon, right? The wise men. 10 times better. And we know he has the Spirit of the Lord among him. We've seen that again and again. He has this special ability. He can interpret visions. He can interpret dreams. He can solve enigmas. But what I find extraordinary in this passage is that nobody can find any dirt on Daniel. Okay? If you want to find out about your history, you know, you could go to ancestry.com and you can, like, pay some money and find out a little about you and your past or your history, or you could go into politics and you can find it out for free. Okay, you can just go get it all out there, let them find it for you. Okay, if anything's hidden, it's going to come to light. And these guys had Daniel, they had him tailed. You know, they got their CIA, their KGB, their MI6, they get them all involved. They're going to see what they can dig up on Daniel, and they come up empty-handed. He's a man of character. A man of integrity, okay? Which also tells me something about why they were trying to get rid of him. By the way, what was James Comey's reward for doing what he thought was right? Is he still serving right now? He got a pink slip, didn't he? He's gone. We don't want someone with integrity. We want someone who is loyal. Same situation here. Daniel is faithful, we're told. No negligence, no corruption is found in him. He doesn't take bribes. He doesn't fudge the numbers. You know, he doesn't steal office supplies. He doesn't clock in late. He doesn't leave early. He's impeccable. Squeaky clean. A man above reproach. Which, by the way, is the standard, according to Paul, for leadership in the church. If you want to serve in the church, you are to be someone who is above reproach, like Daniel. You say, "I don't know if I'm like Daniel." Say, amen. But we're not looking for a super saint, okay? We're looking for the mature. It's a, if you know you've got skeletons in your closet, get them out. The Lord is compassionate, merciful, forgiveness. We're all sinners here. But we were washed, okay? Redeemed. And you can become a man or a woman above reproach. Okay, you may be a vessel currently for common use. You can become a vessel for holy use. Set apart to service for God. Okay? Present your members to be useful to the Lord. Be someone above reproach. Here, Daniel, he is a man above reproach. Unlike who? Yeah, unlike the commissioners and unlike the satraps, you know, his two contemporaries that are supposed to be watching over everybody, well, they're crooked, right? It reminds me, you know, I'm saying, what's going on here? Why is there animosity? Yes, there's animosity because of Daniel's character. There's also animosity because of his lineage, right? It is through Daniel the Christ is coming. Do you think Satan knows who Daniel is? You think he cares? Okay, if Daniel's wiped out, we don't have this book. We don't have his visions recorded. So we haven't even made it to where we're getting messages about the 70 weeks and how the Lord is going to bring Messiah on the scene. And by the way, he's going to get wiped out, but that's okay because he's coming back after that. We haven't heard any of that yet. Satan can wipe him out. He's done some serious damage. I think of Genesis 3. I think of what's going on. You know, you think that there are two teams in this story. There's only two sides. This story is an easy story to track. Right? You're either following that seed of the woman or you're following the seed of the serpent. You don't get a side. We don't get a side. You don't have a character. You're either following God and you represent God's character and you're interested in the things that God is interested in and you love your brother who also loves God. Or you're following Satan's character and you hate your brother. You want to kill him. You have Satan's character. What is Satan's character? You know, I think of it in Isaiah 14:14, if you want to look. He wants to be like the Most High. Satan wants to be seen as co-equal with God. Your opinions are valid, Satan. You know? Your ideas are just as good as my ideas. God says, no, you're not recognized. You're not recognized. There's only one. I know of no other. So Satan comes, and what does he do? He's condemned. Genesis 3. He tells the woman, you can be like God. She eats from the fruit. Her eyes are open. She gets to call it for herself. She doesn't really call it for herself. That's Satan's character. She wants to be like God now. Determine right and wrong for herself. To be co-equal. Okay? Same thing going on today. To be co-equal. You want to get in trouble with somebody? In our country? Or anywhere? Ours is a good start. You know, you tell them that their ideas about blank that God has settled are wrong. Yep. They're not recognized. 51% of people in agreement does not change what God has determined. You are not recognized. Yep. They'll start to hate you pretty quick. Yep. Anger, hatred, murder. Yep. It's going to go to murder. That's what you see in the garden, right? So first he's going to say, I'm going to get God to kill his creation. You eat from the fruit, God has to kill you. But if that doesn't work, we get to Genesis 4. Now we have two sides because God has come up with this incredible plan. It was a plan that was settled before the foundation of the earth, but now he's given us his philosophy, the hero's idea of how he's going to solve the problem. Look, the seed of the woman is going to come. And those who trust in the seed of the woman, they're delivered. So we come to Genesis chapter 4 and we have two sons, right? One offers an acceptable sacrifice. It's looking forward to this seed of the woman. One doesn't. He gives a sacrifice from human reason. Okay. What does the one do to the other? Well, he hates him. He takes him out and he talks to him, right? Tries to deceive him. Kills him. Here we have Daniel. Fast forward. He's stuck over here under Gentile ruling powers. He's not corrupt. He's not following their ways. He's not capitulating. He's not getting along with the culture. He's not trying to, well, you know, win in Babylon or Medo-Persia. You know, we just do what they do. No. He's a man of integrity. He's a man of character. They cannot deceive him, so what are they going to do? They're going to kill him. In fact, you know, one thing that's very interesting here is we'll find that the conspirators, they think that Daniel's only weakness, the only thing that they can come up with, his Achilles heel is his devotion to God. It says, we're only going to find one thing against him. It's going to be in the law of his Lord. They've confused his greatest strength for his greatest weakness. Notice what happens. Look at verse 6. These commissioners and the satraps, they came by agreement to the king, and they spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom and prefects and the satraps, the high officials, the governors, all of us, we've consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. Now, it's very interesting. It's here that we begin to see how this Medo-Persian Empire is distinguished from the previous administration. Okay, there's a change that's taken place. Now, previously in chapter 2, verse 39, Daniel mentioned when observing Nebuchadnezzar's dream and interpreting for him this dream, that the kingdom that would follow his, this gold head that was his kingdom, the kingdom that's following it, the silver chest, is going to be inferior to his kingdom. And I ask, how is it inferior? Well, consider how Nebuchadnezzar's rule is described in the previous chapter. Look at chapter 5, just verse 19. Daniel is explaining to this young Belshazzar that Nebuchadnezzar, when he ruled, whomever he wished, at the very end of verse 19, whomever he wished he killed, whomever he wished he spared alive, whomever he wished he elevated, whomever he wished he humbled. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar was above the law, because Nebuchadnezzar was the law. Okay? If you know that, was that old Sylvester Stallone movie? Judge Dredd, right? Judge Dredd, am I saying? I am the law, right? He calls it, that settles it. He changes his mind. Everybody else better get on board. His word is law. Now, who judges the king in this scenario? The king judges the people. Who judges the king? Look at verse 20. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. And Daniel's going to explain to this young Belshazzar that it is the Lord who chooses who is ruling the kingdom. Okay? God judges the king judges the people. That was the order in Babylon. What's going on here? What about the Medo-Persian Empire? Well, the king can make a law, but once it's created, you know, it can't be changed. Darius is subject to his own laws. Now, that sounds pretty good to us, right? We say, you know, that sounds good. Our society kind of works like that. You know, one of our founders described our country, John Adams, says, we're not an empire, but a republic, and a republic of laws, not men. Republic of laws. We're more civilized. But have we succeeded, I ask, in protecting ourselves from the tyranny of the depravity of the human heart by giving sovereignty to laws rather than to men? Have we succeeded in protecting ourselves from our own depravity? Who makes the laws? Oh, well, depraved humans make the laws. And what about when you write a bad law? Oh, that's a problem. Yeah. What's easier to change, a bad law or the heart of a bad king? Well, Nebuchadnezzar got humbled pretty quick. That solved everything. He says, look, now I'm writing Bible tracts and I want everybody to know and you better follow Daniel's God. Norma McCorvey was 22, unmarried and pregnant with her third child in 1969 when she went to a Dallas pizza parlor. And she sat down across from two abortion advocate lawyers. And they urged her to sign paperwork. And not wanting her real name to be known, she scrawled Jane Roe. And that signature allowed the lawyers to use her story. And an unwed mother of two now, unable to obtain an abortion. You know, this is the story. And the case prompted the 1973 Supreme Court decision to legalize abortion nationwide. Okay? Roe versus Wade. In 1994, some of you may have heard, Norma McCorvey became a Christian and a pro-life advocate and sought to have her case reopened. Okay, she said, I made a mistake, horrible mistake. And in her affidavit, she wrote this. It is my participation in this case that began the tragedy And it is with great hope that I now seek to end the tragedy that I began. Because the courts allowed my case to proceed without my testimony, without ever explaining to me the reality of abortion, without being cross-examined on my own erroneous perceptions of abortion, a tragic mistake was made. A mistake that this court has the opportunity to rectify. But in 2005, the justices refused to reopen the case. Norma died February 18th of this year without seeing the law that she helped create be repealed. And to today, almost 60 million children have been murdered subsequent to the ruling of Roe versus Wade in America. 60 million. In our attempt to avoid tyranny, have we actually established a greater tyranny or opened the door? In some cases, it seems to be the case. The politicians in our text approach the king. They approach him in this guise of unanimity. Okay, they have a long list of everybody who's agreed to this. We are all in agreement. This is a great idea. They can't all show up. It'd be a bazillion people there. There's 120 satraps alone. So their representatives come in. We're all in agreement. It's unanimous. You know, we need to demonstrate that our diverse empire has unity. We need to display that unity, King. And what better way to display that we are unified than to seek the same mediator between God and man? And, you know, what better mediator than you, O King Darius? Darius says, well, that sounds pretty good. Why not? You know, if that's what everybody's decided, then it must be a good idea. He's a general. Okay, they're bringing him their ideas. This is what's a good idea. Okay, I'll sign off on it. Whatever. And in an ironic twist, signing this law that appears to elevate the king actually enslaves the king. Okay, he's bound to do what he signed in the law of the Medes and the Persians. He's enslaved to this political conspiracy. So the law of the land now has become an enemy of the law of the Lord. Up until that point, Daniel's had no trouble in Babylon. Okay, he's not rocking the boat. He's somehow able to go about his duties and serve, not just serve zealously, not just serve uprightly, serves in a greater degree than anybody around him. He's standing apart. He's making things happen in Medo-Persia. But now there's a problem. Now there's a conflict. Now the church and the state are together. It's very interesting, you know, that phrase that often gets thrown at us, separation of church and state. Just as an aside here, you know, we talk about it as though the injunction is made to protect the state from the influence of the church. Do you know where that phrase comes from? The guy's name is Roger Williams. He was a follower of John Locke's philosophy. He is the founder of the Baptist denomination. He writes this. He pictures the church as this magnificent garden, unsullied, pure, resident of Eden. He uses the same imagery you see for Israel in Isaiah because he thinks that the church and Israel are probably the same. And he describes this world that he describes as a wilderness. Okay? And he uses for the first time a phrase that we're going to find Thomas Jefferson pick up. He says this: when they have opened the gap in the hedge or wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world, God hath ever broke down that wall itself, removed the candlestick, and made his garden a wilderness. It says when the church allows itself to be polluted by political motivations, when the church becomes a political body, when they're one and the same, it's the church that is suffering, and the Lord will remove your candlestick. He will take that church away. He's going to break it down. Now, what's interesting then is Thomas Jefferson took this, and in writing a letter to a Baptist church, he uses the phrase separation of church and state in order to encourage them, look, as the government, we're not going to come and force you to follow our laws in this way. Like, we're not going to make you offend your conscience in your religion. That's not how we use it anymore. That's not what's happening in our text. The law is now becoming intrusive on Daniel's practice, on his religion. It's going to be a problem. Notice what happens. Verse 6. Chapter 6, verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. And now, in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Okay, I'd like to point out, Daniel doesn't just decide to take a stand and protest because the law is put on the books. Okay, it is not a response to the law. He's doing what he's always done. Okay? This is the consistent practice that he had done previously. A man with more responsibilities than any of us in this room will ever know. He's basically the guy who's running Medo-Persia. Running all the politicians. He's over everything. He finds time 3 times a day to set apart for prayer, for devotion. Spurgeon says, look, suppose the law of the land were proclaimed, no man shall pray during the remainder of this month on pain of being cast into a den of lions. How many of you would pray? I think there would be a rather scanty number at the prayer meeting. Not but what the attendance at prayer meeting is scanty enough now, but if there were the penalty of being cast into a den of lions, well, I'm afraid that the prayer meeting would be postponed for a month owing to pressing business and manifold engagements of one kind or another. And the question is, what is our prayer life, individually, corporately, as a body, demonstrate about our beliefs? Where are we looking to for power to live our lives in a way that is pleasing to the Lord? Where is our dependence? Do you think if only 3 people come to the prayer meeting that God doesn't show up? It's been a while since we've had a prayer meeting. I think it's time we get started back, don't you? It's Christ's church. We would want him to be involved. Daniel wants the Lord to be involved. He's running the kingdom, but the Lord is the one whose kingdom is everlasting. He's the one who has dominion. He gives rule to whom he desires, and Daniel is constantly going to him 3 times a day. He wants the Lord involved. He prays towards Jerusalem. Why towards Jerusalem? Do you remember when Solomon built the temple and he gave his prayer for the temple? Listen to this. This is 1 Kings 8. You don't have to turn there. I'll read it for you. 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 46. This is Solomon speaking of Israel. Lord, when they sin against you, for there is no man who does not sin, and you are angry with them and deliver them to an enemy, so that they take them away captive to the land of the enemy, far off or near. If they take thought in the land where you have been taken captive, or where they have been taken captive, and repent and make supplication to you in the land of those who have taken them captive, saying, we have sinned, and we have committed iniquity, and we have acted wickedly. If they return to you with all their heart and with all their soul in the land of their enemies who have taken them captive, and pray to you toward their land which you have given to their fathers, the city which you have chosen, and the house which I have built for your name, then hear their prayer and their supplication in heaven, your dwelling place, and maintain their cause, and forgive your people who have sinned against you and all their transgressions which they have transgressed against you, and make them objects of compassion before those who have taken them captive, that they may have compassion on them. Okay, Daniel's following the law. Windows open, praying towards Jerusalem on behalf of the corporate entity of Israel, of the nation. And we think of situations that our nation has. We're not Israel. We don't have, you know, we are a nation that is not a nation as the church. But that doesn't mean that the certain entity that we are residing in, you know, Daniel's in Medo-Persia right now. You think he's praying for Medo-Persia? Seek the welfare of the city in which I have placed you? Okay, when he's in Babylon, they're seeking Babylon's welfare because that's where they're at. Babylon's welfare is their welfare. The same thing for us. We have problems in our country, all kinds of problems. Go way back. You look at racial divides, for example, and there's these ideas. Okay, well, how are we going to seek reconciliation? How are we going to seek reparation? And it's you know, all kinds of ideas on that and groups that pop up with that in mind. The question is, what are we to do as Christians? You can pray corporately. Did you know that? You're a priest, a mediator, are you not? Are we a kingdom of priests? What do priests do? Why were these people praying to Darius? He's a mediator now for a month. We have an opportunity to mediate, whatever the situation may be, for ourselves, for our families, for our church, for our country, for our brothers and sisters in other countries. An opportunity. But I guess it depends on what we think about prayer, doesn't it? You know, if that injunction was made, would it change our lives? Would anyone, you know, these guys knew Daniel's habits, right? They didn't just say, well, we'll try this and see if it works. His window is open. They see him all the time. This is his practice. They say, well, and they know that he's not going to stop. Isn't that interesting? They know, regardless of what the law is on the books, he's going to pray to the Lord. Could somebody get one of us like that? What are the things that we do? You know, I think of the certain constraints we have. You don't talk about the Lord here. You don't say this or that. It's who Daniel is. He's not a super saint. It's just who he is. He's an old dude, 80-year-old dude. Spent his whole life in captivity. He loves the Lord. And he can't help it that his speech is just seasoned with grace. And that his life is patterned after love for the Most High God that everybody knows. Everybody knows that he's not going to change. Verse 11, then these men came by agreement. They found Daniel making a petition. Well, well, well. You know, they didn't really have to do it for 30 days. They could just say, let's check it out in one day, and they could have caught him. And, you know, he had three times, right? Three chances in a single day. They come, they catch him. Verse 12, they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign this injunction? And the king says, the end of verse 12, the statement is true, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Then they answered and spoke to the king, will Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, he pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction which you signed, but he keeps making his petition three times a day. Well, I thought everybody was in agreement on this. It's a problem. Notice the king's response. As soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed. He set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. And then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. And a stone is brought, it's laid over the den, it's really a pit, and the king seals it with his own ring, with the signet rings of his nobles as well, so that nothing can be changed in regards to Daniel. I think if this was in our country, we would have just found some way to follow the letter, the law, and accomplish both ends, right? Where's the loophole? Can I, like, defang, declaw the lions and then put them in there? Some toothless lions that they just gum him is about the best they can do. No. The king's trying to find a way around this, but what I find very interesting here, one, it's very interesting that the nobles threaten the king. Right? That's pretty short-sighted. It's pretty bold. Powerful people don't like being told what to do they? I think of the current flag issue that's going on. You got a lot more people kneeling when you told people what to do. When the president, you know. Whether or not it was their position to agree or not, when you enter the scene and you start telling people what to do, that human nature is going to pop up. Well, they're telling the king what to do. You got to follow. It's interesting. They use their signet rings on the seal as well so that the king won't come back, try to get Daniel out. You know, they're trying to pin the king in. But what else I find interesting is that the king tries to encourage Daniel, your God whom you constantly serve will himself deliver you. Would God have delivered Darius if he just said, I'm not going to do it? It's got faith, you know, it's easy, you know, we see people who are going through some terrible trial. It's easy to get there and say, the Lord's going to deliver you. He's going to do this for you. I believe it. Boy, it gets a lot tougher to make those kind of statements when it's you who's got cancer. When you're going through it. The Lord can deliver. He has delivered in here. So far, we've seen it with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Hebrew name was Edad, one of them. The question is, will he? He doesn't have to. Remember their statement? You know, but if not, we know our Lord can deliver us. But if not, let the king know. It's the Lord who reigns. But if not. Hebrews 11. Littered with people the Lord chose not to deliver. In this life. In this life. So Daniel's put to the test. Now, we know how this resolves. Just listen to it. The king goes off. He spends the night in his palace. He's fasting. No entertainment. He's distressed. His sleep fled from him. He rose at dawn, at the very break of day, and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he'd come near to the den, to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice, and the king spoke out and said, Daniel, the servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel responds, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him and also towards you, O king. I have committed no crime. And the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatsoever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. Chapter 1, Daniel refused to eat. Now we have the lions refused to eat. You know, Spurgeon also is the one who said, look, it's a good thing the lions didn't try to eat Daniel. They wouldn't have enjoyed him because he was 50% grit, 50% backbone. Our flannel graphs, I think, of the ones I saw growing up as a kid. You know, you have this youthful guy, Daniel, in the den. That's not who this is. Okay. This is a retirement age Daniel. This is an 80-year-old Daniel. Which just goes to show that we don't get to pick the climax in our story. You know, we're part of the Lord's story, his salvation, redemption story. And he's the author. And he knows the plans that he has. We don't get to pick it. But the decisions that you make along the way are going to influence the outcome at the climax of your part in the story. Daniel's dietary decisions, do you think that affects Daniel's decision before the king with prayer? What's easier? Change your diet? Shut the window when you pray. Pray without speaking. Pray in your head. Go out away from everybody and pray. The decisions we make on a daily basis are going to be those that predetermine the decisions you make when your time comes. Okay, it's not done in a day. These decisions are made over a lifetime. So we look at Daniel, and we see one very interesting thing as his story ends. The king then, verse 24, gives orders. He brings these men who had maliciously, really they ate the pieces of the Jews, the maliciously accused Daniel. They ate his pieces. They cast them, their children, their wives, into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions had overpowered them and crushed all their bones. It's a law of compensation. Whatsoever a man reaps, that, or sows, that he shall reap. That very thing. Not something like it. That very thing. I think of Pharaoh. I'm going to drown all the little Hebrew babies. The Lord drowns Pharaoh's army in the water. I think of Haman. Story of Esther. He's going to build this enormous gallows. I'm going to hang Mordecai on it. No. Haman, you're the one that gets hung on the gallows. The law of compensation. Solomon says, whoever digs a pit will fall into it. The author of Proverbs says, the wicked are overthrown by their evil doing, but the righteous find a refuge in their integrity. Now I say, is that true? Think of the book of Proverbs. We've talked about this before. What are the book of Proverbs? Are they general truths? What's a general truth? Right? Are they true? You know, you say, well, things that could benefit your life that are mostly true but not always true. It's a kind of truth. Like our scriptures are kind of true. Like, you know, is it like Confucius says, wisdom sayings? No. Always true. Always true. The question is when. You might not see it in your lifetime. You may die in faith waiting for it. But there will come a day. The Lord will judge. They are always true. But we're looking at a broader scale, a longer scale. We're looking at the final judgment. Law of compensation. You will reap what you sow. So I look at this. I look at the response with Darius. He makes a decree just like Nebuchadnezzar before him, that in all the dominion of my kingdom, verse 26, they're all to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. His kingdom is the one which will not be destroyed, as opposed to Medo-Persia. His dominion will be forever, as opposed to Darius's. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And so this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So I look at this. I think about this incredible chapter and I ask, what's the point? You know, why was this included? We've talked about how chapters 2 through 7, suddenly Daniel does something really interesting. He starts writing in Aramaic. Okay, it's like the language of the day, the lingua franca that everybody can read. Okay, and then he's going to go back to Hebrew after chapter 7. And I notice that in chapter 3, we already have the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they're delivered from the fiery furnace. I say, okay, well, I see. Yeah, God can deliver. I understand that. But if not, he still rules. Is it possible that this also has something for the nations, us? I ask, did anybody die in chapter 3? Did anybody die in chapter 6? Yeah. I think the encouragement that comes with this repetition that we find, yes, it is the Most High who rules. Yes, he's still in control. Even while Israel is in exile, he still has a plan. His purposes will still be accomplished. The Messiah is still coming. Yes, he's the one who can seat and dethrone whoever he wants. The greatest Gentile power is nothing compared to the mighty God. But I think this comes with a warning. It comes with a warning. For us who may not know the Lord or the Most High God, for us who may be predisposed with animosity towards those who know the seed of the woman, right? Two teams on this. It's saying, what team are you on? Well, if you're on that other team, you need to know how this thing's going to end up. You need to know who's calling the shots. I think there's a warning. I look at this and I look at how God's narrative is just so incredible. The more we go through it, the more we see, you know, history, we've mentioned it, does not repeat itself. It echoes. The same exact thing doesn't happen again, but we see similar things as it's leading up to that ultimate thing. So I see many judgments and many tribulations, but we know there will be a great one coming. We see pictures of Christ before he comes, and characters like Joseph or Daniel who are faithful in the situation the Lord has placed them in. And I look at the comparison in the same way I recognize that these politicians conspire against Daniel. Well, of course, the chief priests and the elders, they're going to conspire against Christ. And as they could find no corruption in Daniel, the chief priests could find no reason to put Jesus to death. Darius unsuccessfully tries to save Daniel. Pilate unsuccessfully tries to save Jesus. And although Daniel was blameless, there's a big difference between him and Christ. Christ was sinless. Who not only faced the prospect of death, he went through it. Okay? The only person who the law of compensation is not working out for, the one who didn't deserve it, had to go through it. He was obedient to the Father, so that we could be redeemed and restored.